Our column got smaller and smaller. Probably only half the girls who had left Grünberg remained. We would not be able to stand much more. Hearing a peasant woman speak to another in the dialect of Bielitz inspired me with what I considered a wonderful idea. That evening I told Ilse my plan. In one or two days we would disappear into the woods and wait there for the night. When we were sure that our group had left the region, we would rip the stars from our clothing. Our coats were shabby, but we counted on my ski boots to make an impression. No one in camp had shoes like that, perfect for the season. Now came the hardest, but I felt most effective part of my plan. We would go to the nearest police station. We feared the police as we feared death itself, but I banked on their awareness of our fear. In their arrogance, I thought they would not think Jews capable of overcoming it. We would say that we were evacuees from Silesia. Ilse and I both spoke that type of German. That we had gone to find shelter for our mother and baby sisters and brothers. The fact that we had a big family would add another touch of truth, for all good Germans had lots of children for the Führer. We would say that when we returned, our family had gone. There would be questions, of course. Our papers were with Mother, who had them in a bag with all our valuables. We would use our own first names, Ilse and Goethe. They sounded good in German. Our last name would be Kugler. We would be asked if we belonged to the BDM. Yes, of course, we were in the Hitler Youth. I memorized a chapter number. Our father was in the Wehrmacht. His serial number? I thought myself very clever to devise a foolproof way not to forget a complicated serial number. Ilse's house number, mine, and the year the war started. 569-41939. It sounded impressive and would be easy to remember. Our father, we would say, was fighting on the Russian front. I felt that by walking straight into the lion's den we would overcome the first suspicion. Besides, I thought, the police now had too many problems to stage a big investigation. In my mind, I tried to prepare as complete and simple a plan as possible. I knew they might question Ilse and me separately. Our stories had to check. I had staged many dramatic performances in Bolkenhain. This would be my greatest coup. I was painfully aware that I held Ilse's life as well as my own in my hands. Then I told Seuss and Liesel. They thought the idea sound, and said that they would drop from the column a couple of days later and cook up a similar story. All night I rehearsed with Ilse. "Ilse, remember," I repeated, "we cannot be afraid of the police. They are our friends, Germans as we are." It had now been 2 days since we had seen the Silesian peasant women. If we escaped the next day, stayed in the woods that night, and went to the police on the fourth day, we surely ought to be safe. In the barn we kissed Seuss and Liesel goodbye, for we intended to escape in the late afternoon. I was excited all day. As if in answer to my wishes, we did not have our rest break until around 4 in the afternoon. Shadows were already long on the snow. "Perfect," I whispered to Ilse. "When the SS is not looking, we will crawl into the woods." I glanced at Seuss. Our eyes met. Liesel bit her lip, as she always did in moments of emotion. I lifted one eyebrow, signaled Ilse to get behind a tree. She looked at me, her eyes big and frightened. Then she caught my hand. "Goethe, not now," she whispered. "Please, not now. I am afraid." Until then, I had not been afraid. Excitement had buried my fear. Only when Ilse showed her fear did my doubts come to the surface. What if our plan did not go well? Until that moment, I had discounted that possibility. I knew that we just had to escape. But now I hesitated. The decision was not mine alone. Ilse's life was as dear to me as my own. I looked at her again. "We must go," I wanted to whisper. Instead, I heard my voice saying, "Maybe tonight." "All assemble," the voices of the SS rang out. For some moments we stood ready. Then we heard screams and frightened begging from the forest. 3 SS men had rounded up 14 girls in the forest. Now they lined them up in front of us. The commandant took out his pistol. The girls screamed. The commandant fired again, and the girls fell one on top of the other. I closed my eyes and held Ilse's hand tightly. We marched on. At that moment I vowed that I would never try to escape, never take our lives into my hands, never step off the path that was leading us to death. A week passed, two, perhaps three. We lost count of time. About every second day there would be warm soup, if one were lucky enough to be among the first in line, cold soup when one was among the last. At times there wasn't enough to go round. We usually slept in barns. One night we rested in a bombed-out church, listening to artillery fire both from the east and farther away from the west. We felt ourselves lucky if we found a few grains of wheat or oats in the barns. Everywhere we left some dead. Some we buried, others we simply left. Hundreds of girls had frozen feet, bloody and full of pus. I saw one girl break off her toes as though they were brittle wood. Waking one night in a barn, I felt the girl next to me leaning too heavily on my legs. I protested. She did not move. My legs ached. I felt crushed under the weight. I tried to push her and found she was dead. I remembered her from Bolkenhain. She had worked at the loom next to mine. I don't remember her name, but I do remember the way she stooped over the loom to repair a thread, the way she smiled when our eyes met. One girl spotted a milk can leaning against a tree. She ran out of line to see if there were any milk in it. An SS man grabbed her by the neck, forced her to her knees. I saw her turn, petrified, when he took the rifle from his shoulder. "Mercy, mercy," she pleaded. She threw her arms up as he fired. Was it in prayer or desperation? And as he turned to go, the SS man kicked her aside. I watched it all in horror and wished that I were dead. There were planes roaring above us. We heard machine guns in the distance. The front lines were not far, yet they weren't close enough. How fortunate the soldiers were to be able to carry guns. I had dreams about stealing a gun from an SS man during the night and shooting them all, but those were only dreams. I didn't even know how to fire a gun. Why did we march? Why did we let them slaughter us? Why did we not try to fight back? What difference would it have made if they had killed some of us? We were dying anyway, and they would kill the survivors sooner or later in any case. Our group shrank to a quarter of its original size. Why should I hope? I thought. Why should I be free, and the others dead? Why should I think that I would be a privileged one? But these thoughts were dangerous. I had to hope. I had to go on to the end. If Papa, Mama, and Arthur survive, they will wait for me, hoping and praying. I must not disappoint them. Be strong, Arthur had whispered almost 6 years before. Be strong, Mama had called over the mass of voices as I left Bielitz. The snow melted and it became mild. It could almost have been spring. For miles and miles now we saw road signs pointing to Dresden, a big, beautiful city. I remembered it from my history books. We must have marched about 250 kilometers since Grunberg. The SS evidently wanted to reach the city before nightfall. It was getting dark, and big trucks were constantly coming toward us, forcing us off the road and slowing our march. As we approached the outskirts of Dresden, we heard air raid sirens blowing warnings, and soon hundreds of planes roared through the skies. We stood on a bridge over the Elbe as the SS watched us from the banks. They probably felt the bridge was a likely target, and this would be an easy way to get rid of us. It was as if the world were coming to an end. Giant bombers roared over us. Heaven and earth shook. Houses collapsed like dominoes. People screamed, and some jumped in flames into the icy river. Germany was being destroyed. I was not afraid for my life. I felt triumphant watching Dresden being destroyed. And yet I had a painful feeling of detachment and utter loneliness. I don't remember how long the attack lasted, how we finally got off the bridge. I only remember the triumph and the loneliness. And so passed another night. The mild weather held for a few days, and we marched on. One afternoon, as we passed through Freiburg, the windows of a pretty house were open, and someone inside was playing the piano. Soft music floated in the air. As we came closer, our steps drowned out the music. Only after we passed the house did I begin to hear it again. In my mind, I wrote a story to go with the music. It was about someone who tended a plant all his life, and it never blossomed. Only after the person died did the flower bloom. I looked at Ilse. She was crying without a sound, the way Mama cried when we took Papa to the station for the last time. Chapter 13. It grew colder again, crushing our timid hopes that perhaps nature would be kind and spare us. It was stormy and snow fell constantly. We marched on and on. During the day I wished for the night, and during the icy, fearful night I wished for a new day. As if in a nightmare we walked through bomb-damaged cities. I remembered Chemnitz vaguely from my geography lessons and because my Uncle Leo from Turkey had purchased textile machinery there on one of his visits. Now Chemnitz was rubble, some buildings still smoking. I can still see an old woman with a black shawl collecting wood in a basket. We marched through Zwickau, Reichenbach, Plauen. On and on, with the snow falling, the wind howling about us, and the all-pervading hunger gnawing within us. We were 250 kilometers or more beyond Dresden, more than 500 from Grünberg. There were perhaps no more than 400 girls left. It must have been around the 20th of March. We had been marching for almost 2 months. Now we came to another camp, Helmbrecht. It wasn't a death camp. We saw with relief that there were people there and no furnaces. The SS guards departed and a new commandant took over. The previous commandant left his girlfriend at Helmbrecht. Her golden days were over. We were put into an empty barracks with a dirt floor. I looked at the electrified wire along the fence, and again I had that terrible feeling of being trapped. I thought that our chances of survival were much better out in the open, no matter what the circumstances. Before we entered the barracks, we stood in the freezing courtyard and undressed down to our shoes. Our clothes were bundled up and taken away. We were given a strange assortment of clothing, still wet, that had been dipped in a solution said to kill vermin. I was given a pair of heavy slacks and a thin organdy blouse. Ilse received just a long navy blue coat. The camp consisted of perhaps a dozen barracks. We were housed in one large one. There were Ukrainian women in some of the others, but they had roll call at different hours, and we rarely saw them. The whole camp was encircled by fences topped with electrified wire. Beyond the fences stretched snow-covered plains as far as the eye could see. There were no homes or buildings. We all had diarrhea now. At night, a wooden barrel was put near the door for the use of perhaps 400 girls. We were told that it must not overflow. We had to run all night, stand in line, and plead for our turn. When the SS women came in the morning, they beat us, calling us every filthy word in their vocabulary. Our food was meager. Hungry and without anything to do, the girls began to speak of food, exchanging recipes for the richest pastries. It was terrible to listen to. I tried to tell myself that the gnawing pain in my belly was just like a broken leg. I had to stand the pain, and in time it would get better. It was in Helmbrecht that I met Lily. She was from Hungary. She and her husband, she had no idea where he was, were university professors. I noticed her one morning as we stood at attention for a long time waiting for a kettle of yellowish, tasteless, lukewarm liquid, our coffee. It was one of those mornings of many deaths. It was strange. Some days hardly anyone died. Other days we lost many. Some would fall muttering a few words, but for the most part they fell silently to the frozen ground. Then a creaking wheelbarrow would come and the bodies would be thrown into it. That morning, as I watched the loaded barrow being pushed away, I thought, it will make more trips today. When I lifted my eyes, I met the sad gray eyes of one of the Hungarian girls. Strange as it seems, even under those unspeakable circumstances, there were still prejudices. The Hungarians were not popular with us, nor we with them. "Are you thinking the same thing?" asked the Hungarian girl in beautiful German. "Probably," I answered. "It won't be long until our turn comes," she said matter-of-factly. "Maybe it never will," I replied. "You are silly," she exclaimed. "Do not tell me that you still hope."
"I do, and you do too," I snapped back.
"If you did not, why wait? There it is." I pointed to the charged wire that ringed the camp. She smiled wanly and walked away. That afternoon we heard artillery fire again. We had not heard it since we had arrived at Helmbrecht's. The door of our barracks was locked. I was restless, and as I walked about I saw the girl with the gray eyes sitting on the dirt floor killing lice. "Come, keep me company," she said. I could see the angry glances of our girls as I sat down. They didn't like to see anyone fraternizing with Hungarians.
"Well, well," someone said sarcastically. "The end of the war will come when even the Poles and the Magyars get together."
We burst out laughing, and the laugh sealed our friendship. The days, except for the hunger, were not so bad, but we dreaded the nights. Without bunks or blankets, we had nothing but the earthen floor to lie on. Shivering, our bones aching, we huddled in groups, and we waited for the dawn. One night, somebody shook me out of a sound sleep. It was Tusia, the giraffe-necked girl I had been friendly with in Bolkenhain. I hadn't talked to her in a long time. In a way, I felt guilty about it. I quickly get interested in people, but just as quickly avoid them when they expect to be my only friends. I'm sure that I hurt many people in that way. It was the case with Tusia. I respected her deeply. Her wisdom fascinated me, and she never bored me. But she did irritate me.
"Come on," Tusia whispered now.
I followed her to her sleeping place near the door and the barrel. A terrible stench was all around.
"What is it?" I asked. "I want to talk to you."
"Yes, about what?"
"Just talk."
"Did you have to wake me for that?"
I was vastly annoyed. "Goethe," she whispered again, her hand fumbling in the darkness for mine. "Goethe, do you remember once you said that we would be free for our birthday?"
Tusia and I were both born on May 8th.
"Yes, I remembered." "Will we be free?" she whispered eagerly.
"Yes, of course." I was short with her.
"You don't seem too convinced."
"Tusia, what do you want me to say in the middle of the night when you wake me to ask such questions?"
"Such questions?" she sounded hurt. "Are they not important? Don't you see that I have to know right now?"
Then it dawned on me. Tusia had probably lost her mind. I stopped arguing with her. She pressed my hand.
"Come closer," she whispered. I felt her breath on my face.
"Goethe, it will be wonderful when we are free, but you know we have not talked in a long time. I have watched you. I was hurt by you. But still I am grateful to you. You have given me belief in humanity."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"Your spark has not gone out. It never will. You will hurt people, but you will make them happy." Then she said again what she had said in Bolkenhain. "You are going through mud, but your feet are still clean." She rambled on. I did not interrupt her any more.
"I am tired," she said at last, releasing my hand. I went back to my place beside Ilse, but I could not fall asleep again. The things that Tusia had said were troubling me. It was later than usual when we were led out of the barracks and given our pieces of bread. The sun had risen. As I turned to go back in the barracks, I recognized a body lying face down in the filthy snow.
"Tusia,"
I touched her, thinking she had fainted. Her hand was pointing to an empty tin cup. She was dead. I wished again that I could cry the deep hurt out of me, but I could not. Ilsa tried to say something, but I barked at her to leave me alone. I'm hurting Ilsa, I thought. This is what Tusha meant. I thought about Tusha all that day. What had she meant by my spark? Then it came to me, my making others happy, as in Balkenhayn, when I arranged the entertainment. How happy those upturned faces had been, and how few of those girls were still living. I wonder if I still can do it, I thought. That night I tried it. I went over to a group of girls and swore them to secrecy. This, I knew, would be the best way to broadcast news. Then I told them that I knew from a sure source that the war was going to be over in a couple of days. It could take a week or so at the very most. To make my story better, I threw in a few figures about American divisions, tanks, and planes. The Germans were retreating. They wouldn't kill us now. They were too frightened. Some of the girls were skeptical, others overjoyed, but all in all they seemed glad to accept their lot with the knowledge that there soon would be an end. I told Ilsa the same story, of course. "Who told you all that?" she asked suspiciously. "I can't tell you," I replied. Her eyes widened. "Does that mean that you don't trust me?" "Ilsa, the person who gave me this information risked her life. If I tell you who it was and the secret somehow leaks out, you might give her away under torture." "You know I would die before I told," Ilsa cried passionately. "I know," I acknowledged with great dignity, "and that is why I will not tell you." "Goethe," she said softly, "promise me, please, that when you are free to tell, I will be the first to know." I never gave a promise more gladly. In that horrible camp, we were behaving like the young girls we had been years before. Typical schoolgirls, emotional teenagers, making vows, telling secrets, swearing lifelong devotion. "I would rather die than tell," had been a favorite phrase, so often and so lightly used. Only now death was really close, and keeping a secret unto death might mean but a matter of a few hours, a few days. My stories caught on. I knew by the way the girls looked knowingly at me when I passed. I doubt if the Allied High Command knew as much about the progress of American and English troops as I kept reporting. Girls came to me to ask questions. "Are you sure it is so?" they would ask over and over. "You know it would not be fair." "Not fair?" I asked myself. "Not fair to light a spark of hope, to see a grim mouth smile?" Only Lily and Seuss made no reference to my sensational news. They did not seem glad, nor did they say they did not believe me. Once, though, Seuss remarked, "Too bad you can't write plays now, Goethe. Your material is so plentiful." Chapter 14. One morning we were told that we were to leave Helmbrecht. "No, no," moaned Ilsa. "Are you crazy?" I asked her, full of hope again. I wanted to be in the open. I feared enclosures. Outside, I believed we had a chance. I still had my ski boots, and by now the clothes we had arrived in had come back to us, free of vermin. This we regarded as a big favor. One girl whispered to me as she dressed, "You were right, Goethe. They are afraid of us. We have our clothes again." We assembled for our last roll call in Helmbrecht. No more than 300 answered their names. The commandant made an announcement. "You will rejoice to hear that the greatest enemy of the Führer is dead. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has died, as all the enemies of the Führer will die." Roosevelt dead. Perhaps it was only a bluff. Later we learned that the news was true. The day we first heard it, it was probably April 13th, 1945. We marched away from Helmbrecht in the rain. Ilsa found a margarine wrapper. We licked it dry, tasting the fat. Though we got no food that day, Ilsa said it did not matter. We had had the nourishing margarine. We were comforted. We slept outside that night. It was very cold, and the evidence could be seen in the morning in the many stiff bodies on the ground. That evening, after another day's march, Ilsa suddenly collapsed. "Leave me here," she whispered. "I can't go on." I pulled her to her feet, held her arm around my neck, and dragged her on. "Leave me," she kept begging. "Leave me in the woods. Some peasant will be kind." "I will stay with you," I said. Her voice was strong again. "No, you must go on." "I will not go on without you," I said. "You would not go on without me, would you?" She did not answer. It was almost dark. Somehow we got to a barn for the night. As Ilsa's arm dropped from my neck, she fell in a heap. Tonelessly, as if to herself, she said, "I cannot walk." Horror gripped me. I took off her shoes and rubbed her frozen feet slowly and gently. "It's no use," Ilsa whimpered. Carefully, I put her shoes back on. Then I went to look for Hanka. I had met Hanka in Grünberg while working on the night shift, and from the start we had taken to each other. Occasionally she was called to help in the kitchen, and when she did, she always managed to scrounge extra bits of food for Ilsa and me. Thus, Hanka had become an angel to me whose kindness I shall never forget. During the march, Hanka had remained relatively healthy and strong, and because of this the SS Commandant had ordered her to help with the ill. Now I ran to find her, foolishly hoping that she might have a magic solution for Ilsa. I told her that Ilsa would have to ride in the wagon. It sounded like Ilsa's death sentence. Since leaving Helmbrecht's, we had had a horse-drawn wagon with us on which the sick and dead were transported until there were enough for a mass grave. Then the dead would be unloaded and the sick shot. "I'm going in the wagon, too," I decided. Hanka tried to argue with me, but I soon saw that it was useless. All that night I debated with myself. In the morning, should Ilsa and I remain in the barn under the straw and take our chances, or go in the wagon? I was afraid to stay behind. I was afraid to go on. It was a terrible decision to have to make. In the morning, I dragged Ilsa over to the wagon and lifted her into it. She squeezed my hand and turned away from me. At that moment, I got in, too. When Ilsa saw me, she cried, "No, no, you get off. You can walk." But I knew that at least for that day we would be together. Early in the afternoon, we crossed the Czechoslovakian frontier. The good Czech people at the first village were waiting to greet us despite the shouting and cursing of the SS. They showered us with food. They threw it into the wagon. They brought sausages for the guards, bread and turnips for us. Could there be so much richness in that poor world? We ate, and I stuffed away some bread in my coat. And wonder of wonders, an egg appeared in the wagon. How many years since we had seen an egg? I grabbed it and held it to Ilsa's lips. "You first," she insisted. I took a sip. Ilsa finished the egg. "You should be ashamed of yourself," the others cried. "But Ilsa is sick," I pointed out. "We are all sick," was their answer. I placed great confidence in the magic power of that egg. I was sure Ilsa would walk again. That night we stopped in an orchard. The trees needed just a day or so of sunshine to make the buds burst open. A deep longing for home started burning in me. I suppressed it quickly. The other girls had arrived earlier. Hanka had food and held it out to me. "We got a lot," I told her excitedly. I helped Ilsa to lie down. She was very tired. The night was chilly. My diarrhea made me weak. Before I ran to the other end of the orchard to relieve myself, I placed my supply of bread beneath Ilsa's head. "Watch the food," I whispered. "I will," Ilsa answered. When I came back, Ilsa was asleep, the bread gone. I scolded her when she waked. "You could have watched it," I said in desperation. "I am sorry, sorry, sorry," she repeated. "Stop being sorry," I screamed. I could not sleep, I was so angry. The security of that piece of bread meant so much. Now it was gone. Ilsa was sleeping again.
If we could only escape, I thought. Here the people are kind, they would help us. But now we were in a fenced orchard, and now Ilsa couldn't walk. How could we escape? If I had known the night before how close we were to the Czech border, we certainly would have stayed in that barn. But how could we have known? In the morning we rode in the wagon again. Ilsa slept most of the time. We got no food that day. As evening approached, we were led to another barn. That night, after most of the girls had gone to sleep, Rita Schanzer, my friend of Bielitz days, whispered to me that she was going to try to get away. She wanted me to join her, but Ilsa could not walk at all without help. I could not carry her for any distance. It was ridiculous to think of escape. Next morning was spring-like. I scanned the column but failed to see Rita. Perhaps she had gotten safely away. I hoped so. In the wagon, Ilsa immediately fell asleep. The sunshine warmed our frozen, shriveled skins. It felt strangely bright to our eyes, so long accustomed to darkness. The beauty of the day made me realize how terribly shabby we were. Filthy and stinking, we rode through the gentle Czech countryside. War seemed impossible here. As we passed beneath blooming trees, their branches brushed across the wagon. I tore off a small branch of blossoms and placed it on Ilsa's breast. She woke, smelled it, and smiled. Her eyes looked strange. Her teeth were very yellow. She fell asleep again. The day wore on. We continued through hilly country. It grew much colder. Toward evening, we stopped in a meadow. I was driven away from the wagon by a guard. Stronger girls were called to lift the sick and dead from the wagon. After we had stood roll call, I looked for Ilsa, but could not find her. Then I discovered one of the Hungarian girls dragging her coat from a pile where four bodies lay. Fury possessed me, and I tore the coat out of her hands. "I will kill you," I screamed. Though she did not understand my words, she understood my tone, and she let go of the coat. Ilsa was lying on the wet grass. She only smiled when I put the coat around her. The other three girls were dead. Hanka came and helped me carry Ilsa away from the corpses. Setting her down in a quiet place, I covered her with both our coats and crawled under them next to her. I held her in my arms. With effort, she lifted her hand and stroked my hair. "My poor sister," she whispered, "you will be alone." I cradled her head to my breast to muffle her words. She fell into a light sleep. Liesel brought two potatoes. I ate one and kept the other in my bosom for Ilsa. When she woke, I gave it to her. "I am not hungry," she insisted. "Eat it. Please eat." I was so starved, I ate the potato. Before I finished, Ilsa was sleeping again. A fine drizzle fell. It was wet and cold. Several girls got up and moved around. "Lie down," yelled the SS.
"Water," Ilsa whispered.
I started for the brook nearby. An SS man shouted at me to stop.
"Water for my sister," I begged.
"Get back, you swine." He kicked at me with heavy boots. As he followed me to where Ilsa was lying, he stopped to slap a couple of girls who got up from the wet ground. When Ilsa heard his heavy steps approach, she said feverishly,
"Here, they are coming, our saviors."
"What do you want, you bitch?" demanded the SS guard.
"Water," Ilsa whispered.
He kicked her.
"Why?" Ilsa cried faintly. "Why?"
"God, have you no mercy?" I sobbed. I flung myself across her body.
"Goethe," she whispered. "I don't want to die. I'm only 18. I have something to tell you." Her voice grew stronger. With new energy, she said, "If my parents survive, don't tell them I died like this. Promise me one more thing," she continued. "You must try to go on for one more week." I did not answer.
"One more week. Promise me," she persisted.
"I promise." I hope nobody is angry at me. I am angry at no one. Ilsa, please stop, I begged tearfully. You will be very happy, I know it, she went on. Remember the cards in Bolkenhain? They told us that I am unlucky, but you are a Sonnenkind. In Bolkenhain long ago, someone had read our fortunes. Yes, I remembered. Thank you for everything, she whispered, grabbing my hand. It stopped raining. Before she fell asleep, she licked the few drops of rain I had caught in my cupped hands. I dozed off, too. After a while, she whispered, Hold my hand. I held her hand tightly, and we both fell asleep again. When I woke up, it was getting light. Ilse's hand was cold. Her eyes were half open. She no longer breathed. I ran over to Seuss and Liesel, where they huddled together. Ilse is dead. Ilse is dead, I told them frantically. From somewhere a voice came, Who is Ilse? And another, Why the fuss? We will all be dead soon. I moved away and sat by myself on the wet grass. The sun rose over the hills in a light golden strip, the beginning of the first day that Ilse would not see. Somewhere in the distance a dog was howling. I was alone, so terribly alone. Oh, why was I always alone? Ilse was buried near some trees. I could not bear to watch. The girls who dug a grave told about it later. As I climbed into the sick wagon, Hanka tried to dissuade me. That is sure death. Ilse could not walk, but you can. Just today, I begged. Tomorrow I will walk. Later, as the wagon rolled through the little town, a window opened above us and a piece of bread fell right into my lap. I clutched it. A dozen hands stretched toward me, begging. For a minute I wavered. Then I divided the bread carefully among the girls. Chapter 15. That was a day full of tension. Allied planes were constantly overhead, strafing the woods and our marching column. Obviously, the pilots did not know who was marching. They saw only the green-gray uniforms of the guards. In the evening, when we got to a barn, I saw Liesel. She had been wounded in the leg. It's nothing, she said. It does not even hurt. The barn doors were closed, but the boards did not fit tightly, so that light from the outside streamed in. We had stopped marching earlier than usual, probably because the guards were afraid of the planes. I tried to talk to Liesel and Seuss, but somehow the tie between us was broken. Our group was not the same. With Ilse gone, it seemed that they felt that the three of us who remained couldn't last long. Seuss planned to ride in the wagon next day. She declared herself unable to walk any more. Liesel, whose legs were covered with pus-filled scabs, agreed to join her. When morning came, I started to follow Seuss and Liesel into the wagon. Hanka pulled me back. You can walk, she said firmly. Don't ride again. Meekly I obeyed, though it seemed to make little difference to me. At first my legs hurt so that I thought I could not continue, but as I marched on they felt better. Again and again I found myself turning to my left for Ilse, to my right for Seuss. Girls I did not know were marching on either side of me. We spent another night in a barn. In the morning, at least, 50 more girls were dead. When we filed by to get some soup, I heard a group of guards speaking excitedly. Ist es möglich? One of them asked, and an SS woman answered hysterically, Ja, der Führer ist tot. I felt myself tremble with joy. Seuss, did you hear? I whispered. Yes, she answered, but I am sure that now they will kill us for revenge. I wanted to say no, but something prevented me. Perhaps I thought Seuss was right. We marched on, waiting for something to happen.
With Hitler dead, things had to change. It is happening now, I kept saying to myself. This is the end. One or two more days, and it will be over. But somehow it did not matter so much anymore. With Ilse gone, I did not care, even though I had promised her that I would not give in. The third evening after Ilse's death, we approached a little town in Czechoslovakia, Volary. It was Friday, I learned later. My legs were hurting terribly. I felt that I could not go on. The SS woman now in charge told us to stand in a row in a meadow. Those who were no longer fit, she ordered to stand apart. I was swaying. "You cannot walk any more," she barked, pointing at me. "Take off her shoes," she commanded Hanka, who stood beside me. My shoes, the ski boots that Papa insisted that I wear, the order gave me new determination. Hanka pushed me behind another girl. "Don't let her see you," she whispered. In the fading light, the SS woman ordered our group into a truck. "Shall I help you up?" Hanka asked. There were few seats. The rest of the girls would have to stand jammed together. Girls were begging to get on. "Not yet, Hanka," I said. "Then you will have to go in the wagon," she said. "It will be here shortly." "I am in no hurry now," I replied. The truck rushed away with one SS man and one SS woman and perhaps 30 shoeless girls. The rest of us sat in the meadow waiting for the wagon or for the truck to come back. I looked at the sky. The first stars were out. Occasionally a plane or the sound of artillery broke the silence of the spring evening. An hour passed. Neither the wagon nor truck appeared. I did not feel cold or hungry, only lonely and sad. I allowed myself the rare luxury of thinking of home, of Papa and Mama and Arthur strolling on a spring night in the garden under the darkening sky. I felt strangely consoled. It grew darker. When the truck failed to return, we were led across the meadow toward a large factory building. There were 120 of us left. After we were marched in, the doors and windows were barricaded. Soon afterward, from the silence outside, we gathered that our guards had abandoned us. Much later, I learned from one of the girls who survived that an American plane had strafed the truck that did not return. The woman guard was killed. The SS man on the truck shot a number of the girls. The rest jumped off the truck and ran away. In the silence of the huge hall, we could hear a ticking. So the Germans were going to destroy us after all. We had waited so many years for the end of the war. How many times, years ago at home in the ghetto in Bolkenhain, in Marsdorf, in Landeshut and Grünberg, and while marching all those months had I dreamed of this moment. And now we were not to survive. Then it began to rain. It was a spring rain accompanied by loud thunder. The planes stopped soaring, the artillery fire ceased, and still the bomb outside continued to tick. Then some Czechs came and broke the door open. They urged us to run. The SS men were coming back to shoot us because their bomb had not gone off. Later we heard many stories about that bomb, but we never learned why it failed to go off. We did not pause to look at it. Those who could ran. Some of us headed toward the factory and hid there. Two other girls and I crawled into a huge metal cylinder lying on the floor. There we waited. A couple of hours passed. There was shooting in the distance, and then close by, and again the planes roared overhead. We did not dare to move. Perhaps, I thought, perhaps we will survive, but what then? I will go home, of course. And for the first time in all those years, the thought of going home did not ring right. No, I could not think of it, not yet. There was a loud commotion at the factory door, and we heard heavy boots pound along the concrete floor. A voice shouted in German, "Get out! Out, you beasts! Out!" We did not stir. Shots were fired in our direction. One bullet went through the cylinder, creasing my shoulder and one of the other girl's legs. There was more commotion, and then the Germans departed. We waited again. There was more firing in the distance. Much later, we heard shouting in Czech. A man and two women entered the factory, calling, "If someone is inside, come out. The war is over." We crawled out of the cylinder, stiff and numb. "Look," said the man, pointing to a window. One of the women took my arm to steady me. From the window in the early morning light, I saw a church on a hill. The white flag of peace waved gently from its steeple. My throat tightened with emotion, and my tears fell on the dusty windowsill. I watched how they did not soak into the dust, but remained like round, clear crystals. And that was all I could think of in that great hour of my life. Part 3. Chapter 1. We went back to the immense hall where most of the rest of the girls had gathered. We found chaos, crying and shouts of joy. The hour had struck at last. Somehow I couldn't grasp it. There were no golden trumpets to proclaim our freedom. There were no liberators in sight. Liesel was lying on the littered floor. She knew we were free, but did not seem elated. "Where is Seuss?" I asked her. "She went out to get water and hasn't returned. She has been gone a long time." I went out to look for Seuss. She was not at the pump. I found her off away, lying in the mud. Her eyes were glassy, unseeing, but for a moment I did not realize she was dead. "Seuss, we are free," I called to her. "We are free. The war is over." When I touched her, I knew the truth. I did not tell Liesel. It was too sad for Liberation Day. As I look back now, trying to recall my feelings during those first hours, I actually think that there were none. My mind was so dull, my nerves so worn from waiting, that only an emotionless vacuum remained. Like many of the other girls, I just sat and waited for whatever would happen next. In the afternoon, a strange vehicle drove up. In it were two soldiers in strange uniforms, one of whom spoke German. The German mayor of the town was with them. He was trying to tell the two soldiers that he really was not anti-Semitic. The soldiers were Americans. I knew as soon as I heard them speak to one another. Arthur had spoken their language a little. Tears welled from my eyes as they approached us. The German-speaking soldier patted me with his clean hand. "Don't cry, my child," he said with compassion. "It is all over now." "We must return to headquarters," said the other one in German. "Can you girls wait until morning? We shall return." I remember nothing else happening that day. The next thing I remember was waking up wrapped snugly and warm in a coat which the SS had left behind, waking up with what I thought was a smile which must have seemed more like a grimace in my pitifully thin face. The austere hall was bathed in sunshine, and I woke up with the knowledge that I was free. I was eager to go outside, to move about freely. Perhaps I would meet the Americans again. I swayed as I started to walk. My skin was hot and dry. As I reached the door, the first thing I saw was that strange vehicle bouncing toward us through the brilliant May sunshine. I was overcome with joy. I called to the other girls that some Americans were coming. The soldier on the left made a motion to the driver, who stopped the vehicle across the yard from where I was standing. The soldier jumped out and walked toward me. He wasn't the one who had come the day before. Shaking my head, I stared at this man, who was to me the embodiment of all heroism and liberty. He greeted me. "I must tell him from the start," I resolved, "so that he has no illusions about us." Perhaps I had acquired a feeling of shame. After all, for 6 long years, the Nazis had tried to demean us. "May I see the other ladies?" he asked. Ladies? My brain repeated. He probably doesn't know, I thought. I must tell him. We are Jews, I said in a small voice.
So am I, he answered.
Was there a catch in his voice, or did I imagine it? I could have embraced him, but I was aware how dirty and repulsive I must be.
Won't you come with me?
He asked. He held the door open. I didn't understand at first. I looked at him questioningly, but not a muscle in his face moved. He wanted me to feel that he had not seen the dirt or the lice. He saw a lady, and I shall be forever grateful to him for his graciousness. I want you to see a friend of mine, I remember telling the American, and we started to walk toward Liesel. On the dirty, straw-littered floor, Lily was lying, covered with rags. As we tried to reach Liesel, she looked up, her eyes enormous, burning in their sockets. She looked at my companion, and her face lit up with a strange fire. I heard her say something in English and saw how the American bent down closer and answered her. Her hands were shaking as she gently, unbelievingly touched the sleeve of his jacket. In the exchange that followed, I made out the word happy. I understood that word. Then she sighed, released his hand, and looking at him, shook her head and whispered, "Too late." We moved on to Liesel. Liesel just smiled and said nothing. She didn't seem to care much. I looked back at Lily. Her eyes were fixed on the American. A solitary tear ran down her cheek. An ant was crawling over her chin. Shortly afterward, Lily died. I heard the American give commands in English. He seemed furious that things weren't moving fast enough. He explained to me in German that a hospital was being set up for us. Then he asked me, "Is there anything I can do for you in particular?" "Yes, there is," I said. "If you would be kind enough and could find the time. You see, I have an uncle in Turkey. Could you write to him, let him know that I am alive and that I hope he has news from my parents and my brother?" He took out a notebook and removed the sunglasses he had been wearing. I saw tears in his eyes. He wore battle gear with a net over his helmet. And as he wrote, I looked at him and couldn't absorb enough of the wonder that he had fought for my freedom. He snapped his book shut. "I would like to ask you a question," he said softly. "But please don't answer if you don't want to. We are aware of what has happened. Tell me, were you girls sterilized?" I did not answer at once. I was too full of emotion. Why should he, of all people who looked to me like a young god, inquire about the deepest treasure that I, who must have looked like an animal to him, carried still within me? "We were spared," I managed to say. A few moments later, joined by his companion and the mayor, he drove off. Before I had even asked his name, he vanished. Within an hour, Red Cross trucks arrived. Litter-bearers gently but swiftly loaded the ill. Other soldiers carried girls in their arms like babies, speaking to them soothingly in words the girls did not understand. But the gestures of warmth and help were unmistakable. In a trance, I walked to a truck and got in. On the soldiers' sleeves was a red diamond, the insignia of the 5th U.S. Infantry Division. Their uniforms, their language, their kindness and concern made it true. We were finally free. The hospital we were taken to was a converted school. Wounded German soldiers had been moved to the third floor so that we could be installed in the first two floors. How strange! In a matter of one day, the world had changed. Germans were put out to make room for us. We were taken to a room where huge cauldrons of water were being heated on a stove. Round wooden tubs stood steaming on the floor. A woman in a white coat motioned me to undress. Doing so, I stepped into one of the tubs. The warm water reaching to my neck felt strange. It had been at least 3 years since last I sat in a tub. Bidding me stand, the nurse soaked my body with quick, invigorating pressure. It was pleasantly painful to sit back in the tub again and let the warm water engulf me. A young peasant girl came in, her cheeks rosy and shining, her colorful peasant skirt reaching to her ankles, her deep-cut blouse revealing her full bosom. I felt slight and thin. When I saw the girl gather up my clothes in a basket, I looked at the nurse with a questioning glance. "They will be burned," she said. Only one thought remained. With my wet hand, I reached for my ski boots, took the left one, and reached under the lining. There was the dirty, shapeless package containing the pictures I wanted to save. I pulled the pictures out and laid them on the dry towel beside the tub. And the other packet, the poison I had bought in Grünberg, I gratefully let go to the fire. I stepped out of the tub. The nurse dried my body and hair. As I stood nude before a clean blue and white checkered man's shirt was put on me, I realized abruptly that I possessed nothing, not even a stitch of clothing that I could call my own. I owned only the pictures of Papa, Mama, Arthur, and Abeck that I had carried for 3 years. A blanket was thrown over my shoulders as I was led to a bunk. The sheets were fresh and white. A nurse brought me a drink of milk. Milk? I hadn't had any in 3 years. As I drank it, something tremendous and uncontrollable broke loose within me. My body shook convulsively. I wanted to stop it, but I couldn't. I heard my voice and could do nothing about it. A nurse hurried up, then a doctor. I heard him say, "No, let her cry it out." Long pent-up emotions finally burst out. I cried for Ilse, for Seuss, for other friends, and finally for my family, too. Deep in my heart I had known they were dead, but dreams about happy reunions with them had kept me going. When I opened my eyes, a night had passed. A nurse was approaching with a breakfast tray. "This is the life of a fairy princess," I thought. As I lay daydreaming after breakfast, there was a sudden commotion. Nurses hurried in. "Germany has capitulated," they told us. "The war in Europe is over." For me, the war had ended with my liberation. I had not realized that the fighting had continued after that. I looked out the window. Coming down the hilly, winding road was a company of unarmed and bedraggled German soldiers. As they passed my window, I could see their unshaven faces and hollow cheeks. Proud, handsome American soldiers guarded them. A doctor and a nurse came in. They stopped at each bed. After asking my name and birthplace, the doctor asked for my date of birth. May 8, 1924. "May 8?" the doctor exclaimed. "Why, today is the 8th.
"Happy birthday," the nurse chanted.
After they left, I repeated to myself, "It's my birthday, my 21st birthday, and Germany capitulated." I thought of Tuzia, who had so desperately wanted my assurance that we would both be free on this day. I remembered her lying dead in the snow. Why am I here? I wondered. I am no better. As I lay back on my white, clean pillow, lost in thought, I heard someone approach. It was the doctor again. He put something in my hand. "For your birthday," he said, smiling. It was a piece of chocolate. Chapter 2. I don't remember the days that followed too well. The doctors and nurses spent much time over me. I was given injections and pills continuously. My body was rubbed with oil twice a day, for my skin was flaked and dry. I was weighed, 68 pounds. The nurses joked about being able to circle my thigh with their fingers. My bed seemed very high up, and the distances enormous. I did not feel like talking to anyone,
I was strangely silent for the first time in my life. I noticed that many of the girls began to have visitors. I asked for Liesl several times, but was never told where she was.